when the shift boss hits that button, then you'd better look alive, 'cause the lumber comes a-rolling like the bees out of a hive. And you'll feel that sweat come pouring as each muscle screams with pain. And you'll wonder if it's worth it working on the long green chain.
Hi, I'm Mark Laren Young, and welcome to the Tyee Podcast. Wade Fisher started out working in the bush near Williams Lake setting chokers. He also drove skidders, and he did just about every mill job there is, including running edgers, barkers, chippers, and loaders. In 1979, he became an officer in the union local for the International Woodworkers of America, and he spent the next 30 years as one of labor's most respected voices in BC. A few months ago, I was in Williams Lake, and I met Wade to talk about the forest, the trees, and meeting the beetles.
In the last few years, anybody that has done union work, it's a pressure cooker, because there's nothing good happening. Every situation you're in, especially in the forest industry, is, even if you do something that's good, it's good only to the in respect to, if you hadn't have done something, you'd have lost 15 jobs. So you've done something, and you get to say, well, boys, we saved 5 jobs. You know, so you still got 10 people going down the road. And so it's very... been very tough in the forest industry.
What is the union position on the pine beetle? Like, what are you putting forward that?
Well, what the union wanted was to have an element where you could look at pensioning people off to keep jobs for younger people. They wanted to do some pension bridging. They wanted to have some money for training in advance, so that you don't wait till a guy's on the street to start training them, because we learned some time ago, we ran an education program here a few years back, and we know from that if you train people while they're actually working, it's cheap. But if you wait till a guy's unemployed and you got to support his family while he's training, that's real expensive. If you're working and I can pay for your courses and you can do your courses while you work, that's pretty cheap. And so what we also know about the forest industry is that a lot of our people need a lot of training, education, before they're ready to take any kind of meaningful training. You take a guy that's worked in the forest industry for 25, 30 years. He's 48 or 49 years old. He probably got out of school 17 years old, if he stayed that long, and many guys in that age bracket didn't stay that. They were out when they were 16 years old and working. So to take that guy and say, oh, you're done here today, you're going to go take some training, well, he don't even have the basics to take the training. So what we did a few years ago is we had a course ran for 3 years under the Harcourt government. We got funding for it. And we were actually the first to do it, and then they started these, I forget what they called them, but they went all over the province. But in our case, we had a program where the basis of the program was you train people while they're working, and you don't differentiate between what kind of training they can take. Our approach was that the people that need training most aren't the people that start taking training. So we wanted to create an atmosphere in the workplace where the highest paid and most skilled guys were taking training, so that the other people looked at it and said, well, if that guy's doing it, it must be good. So yeah, that we could get... So for the higher skilled guys that had their grade 12 or maybe a university education, we wanted them involved in training so that we brought others along. And that's the approach we took. And we offered dogwood diplomas. We even put some people through, and we took a lot of flack for this in Victoria. We even put a guy through as a commercial pilot. They said, well, why'd you do that? Well, he was a highly skilled guy. We wanted those guys involved in training. So we wanted him in. He wanted to become a pilot. He had a pilot's license. He wanted to become a commercial pilot. So we arranged to have him get his instrument rating. Once he had his instrument rating, he was away to the races. Because the guy put a lot of effort in himself. So we done a number of things like that. But what was really amazing about that is we had a person in this community who couldn't read or write, who went and got his Dockwood diploma in 3 years and graduated. That's the kind of thing that we in the union movement wanted to see.
Tell me about the Dockwood diploma.
Well, the Dogwood Diploma is the same diploma you get if you go right from grade 1 to grade 12 in the school system. Exactly the same diploma. It's not where you went and wrote a GED, you know, an equivalent. You actually end up with a diploma from School District 27 that said you've completed grade 12 education. That's a Dogwood
nice.
Diploma. So the guy has got a diploma that's good anywhere in the world. It's a recognized... in fact, we even hired teachers from the school district to help tutor our guys and work with them. And it was all done on an individual basis. You could sign up and you could work. We had one guy who just wanted to get his grade 12. He had had grade 10 or 11 in school. He got his Dogwood diploma and went on to do advanced mathematics. Just tremendous. He didn't realize he had this gift for mathematics. Don't want to mislead somebody, but I believe he done 2 years of university advanced mathematics right here in town in the community while he was working. He didn't quit the mill. He's still working in the mill. But that guy's confidence, the employer said to me that to watch that man, the change in him, finding out how bright he actually was and what he could learn, was a tremendous difference. Just they could see the difference, and he was a more valuable employee to that company after he had went through that training than he had been before. So even though he didn't use it, he's packing that around, and that guy is a very confident individual today.
Is the pine beetle the scariest thing out there in the forest right now for workers?
I don't believe so.
Okay. What is?
The scariest thing out there is the fact that the government has given up on forest workers. In my opinion, that government has given away the farm to the big companies. When they removed a pertinency a few years ago, and people will tell you that a pertinency never saved a job.
Can you please explain the term for me?
Okay, a pertinency was a section in the Forest Act that allowed government, if you had tenure, it was a social contract that was signed when companies got tenure in this province. You've heard of the social contract. Well, when the social contract was supposedly entered into, what that social contract said is you'll get timber, but for that timber you're going to provide jobs in communities to help build rural communities and make them sustainable and all of that good stuff. Well, what happened was this government we've got today under Gordon Campbell came along and removed the appurtenancy section. And the argument they used with the public, you couldn't stand up and call them liars because what they said was true. Appurtenancy by itself never saved one job. A pertinency alone did not. But what did happen was, when the appurtenancy section was there, for they removed it, if you owned tenure and you said, I'm shutting this mill down and I'm going to truck these logs to the next community, government could step in under the Forest Act and say, hold on. You got to prove to us that you're not economical. If you can prove we're not economical, you can transfer your timber. But you got to prove that. Government would come in with a specialist in the industry, look at the books, look at what the company was doing. And in lots of cases, what happened in this province was they come back and said, that company can run. That company can be profitable. And here's the recommendations to fix what they're doing. And we had mills In Revelstoke, for instance, that mill would have been shut down. I believe it's down today, but that mill would have been shut down 10 years ago. But it wasn't shut down because the government came in with specialists and looked at what was needed and offered the suggestions to fix it. Now, the guy that owned the mill could have said, no, I'm not doing anything. But if he'd have done that, he'd have lost his tenure. He'd have lost his tenure. When the government took that away, what they basically said is, you've got tenure, you've got it forever, and the price you were supposed to pay to the people of the province of British Columbia, you no longer have to pay. It's like me going out and getting a mortgage and committing to pay the bank, and all of a sudden one day, the government comes along and says, oh, bank, you're not getting that money from that guy. He gets to keep his house, and you don't have to pay. He don't have to pay you. That was the price we, the people, were supposed to get for tenure. We're not getting that price.
What was the official reason for doing this, and what do you think the reason was for doing this?
Well, the official reason, it's been a while now, the official reason at the time was that they were streamlining it and making it less red tape, and they said that it didn't work anyway. But under the previous government, Harcourt government, there were several mills. The Squamish mill, I think, was another one that was dealt with under a pertinency and kept running at the time. And it was just shut down here this year, right? Last year, I guess, now. But the problem with this is that what it allows is it allows for companies to not create jobs in communities. It allows them to move wood wherever they choose to move it. It allows for the sale of that wood. And they say, well, that would happen anyway. But the reason it allows for the sale of the wood for export, and I'm talking about export here, is you create no demand for the wood. And if you have no demand for the wood, you can apply for an export permit. Okay? Well, if you allow people to shut mills down that are economical, it don't take very long for there's no demand in the area for the timber. And once there's no demand in the area for the timber, you get to apply for an export license. We've had export...
So this is about exporting raw logs to the States?
You bet it is. We had... I've been away from it for a while now, and I don't remember the exact figures, but we had enough wood exported out of Terrace area to run a mill the size of... one of these big mills here in town for over a year. And one fall swoop, 300,000 cubic meters, just gone for export because there was no demand in the local area for that wood. Well,
hang on, so instead of sending it from Terrace to, say, Quesnel, Williams, yeah, Lake, Prince George, they were allowed to ship it to the U.S.?
You bet. It's a matter of record.
Now,
in fact, if you read Hansard, it's in there.
Why wouldn't mills, say, turn around and go, forget about Williams Lake, forget about Quesnel, we're going to build one gigantic mill in Kamloops?
That's a great example, because that's already happening in Prince George. It's happening in Quesnel. West Fraser just built a mega mill in Prince George, or in Quesnel. Canfor built a mega mill in Houston. And them mega mills, I mean, they just haul wood in for miles and miles and miles. But what they don't tell you is that local communities are dying because of this. Canfor just shut a mill down in Mackenzie. Permanently gone. But that's happening all over the place in this province where communities are going to die because the mills are shutting down and they're getting to move logs wherever they want, with the government now having absolutely no say in how that's done. It used to be the government had say. You know, you had to have the right log to the right mill. They said that for a number of years. But they were able to control the movement of logs so that you couldn't just export the jobs out of a community. today, there's no barrier. And so consequently, what you're seeing in the forest industry is it's an example of this, the bigger getting bigger, the smaller disappearing. They're virtually gone. It's the odd one. We got one success story here in Williams Lake, Sigurdsson Brothers. They're doing well. You know, they're an independent. But the independents are disappearing out of this industry. And so consequently, you're seeing a fairly major change. And we're just seeing the tip of the iceberg. I mean, don't get me wrong, the beetle is a huge problem. You know, it is. But I think the beetle is a problem that could have been looked after. But we've had governments, and I say governments, that have failed to put enough money into the hands of the people that look after them problems to deal with it. They were told several years ago about the bugs. We talk about this huge clear cut in Wells Gray Park, you know, where they had all the blowdown and all that. Well, that was a small, isolated problem that we should have went in and logged that area and got rid of the problem. But we didn't. We left that blowdown there. And what that did is allowed the bugs to get a huge start. And they've just grown every year. We haven't put the money. We didn't put the money in to deal with the problem. We should have. If you're talking to the so-called experts, people that deal with bugs, they know that there's things they could have done, but the money wasn't provided to do that.
Well, I know it was also weather, because I remember when I lived here.
Weather's a problem.
Yeah, when I lived here ages ago, back when I was a reporter at the Williams Lake Tribune, yeah. I remember it hit 35 below. I never survived 35 below, and I didn't know people could when it happened. But I remember 35 below, and that the forestry people here were really disappointed. It didn't last, I think it was 2 more days.
Yeah.
They said if it lasted 2 more days, it would have killed off the bark. Yeah. I remember them being called the bark beetle at the time.
Yeah, that's exactly it.
That it would have killed off the bark beetle. It went 2 more days, yeah. And all of the foresters I was talking to were just devastated.
But that's part of the problem. I think governments thought, well, if we get some weather, we don't have to deal with it. We don't have to spend the money to deal with the problem. Weather will look after it.
So you're saying there was a way to do it without hoping for the 35 below days?
My understanding from people within the forestry that look after that, there were ways to deal with it. Whether they would publicly say that, I don't believe they would, because I would suspect their job wouldn't be long. I think people that work for government in those kind of jobs are really under the gun. I mean, they make recommendations, and government says, well, no, we're not going to do that, we're going to do this, and this is what you're going to do, so it sort of flows. But my understanding from talking to the people that work in those fields, they tell me there was things that we could have done. And I know that we've got a major fir beetle problem in this area, which nobody's talking about. Nobody's talking about it. And we got a major problem with fir beetle. And that's coming. So there's more than the pine beetle out there, eh? It's just the pine beetle has just been so devastating that it's even affecting our tourism operators. I don't know if you've heard that.
No.
But I understand I don't have first-hand knowledge of this, but my understanding is that Utsa Lake, the beetles are falling in the water in the lake, and the fish are eating them, so the fish aren't biting. And so they're having, you know, the tourists come in to fish, and the fish won't bite. I understand that when they open them up, they're full of these beetles. Now, because they're eating them, eh? And so the fish don't need to bite. They've got lots of food. And so... I understand. I was talking to some people that come back from one of the tourism operators, and he's pretty concerned. I mean, you know, his livelihood's on the line with these stupid beetles filling the fish. So,
if somebody came at you tomorrow and said, Wade, we're making you minister of forests. You can do anything you want. What would you do to fix forestry in BC?
I would certainly try and bring back a pertinency or some form of control. I guess maybe a better word for it is a pertinency was a word that most people didn't know or understand. That was part of the problem, I think. But I think you need to be able to use the levers of power in government to make sure that communities survive and that business survives. I mean, they both got to survive. But you can't have one survive at the expense of the others. And that's what's happening in rural BC today. Business is surviving, but the communities and the people in them are going to be in real trouble. We're just seeing the tip of the iceberg with this mill closure in Mackenzie. I think we're going to see a lot more of that.
Now, I want to go back to one thing that I'm actually going to move at the beginning if I'm able to use this, which is, can you tell me a bit about your history? Because I gather you started in the logging industry in 75?
Oh, I started in the logging industry in 1969.
Okay, then.
And started working in the bush, setting chokers, actually. And in the days when we logged with cats, a thing of the past. I went to work at the plywood plant and got involved in the union and was elected, I guess, in 1979. I was elected the second vice president of the local union here. Prior to that, I was plant chairman in the plant I worked in for about 5 years. After 1983, I became a full-time second vice president of the local union and first vice president. Then I was financial secretary for a number of years and then president of the local. And then I, about 3 years ago, I moved to fourth vice president of the national union and ended up my working career in third vice president of the national union. And then we merged with Steelworkers. And I worked with Steelworkers for about a year, and then I retired. So it's been an interesting go. But in there, I've done some interesting things. I was a co-chair of an economic action forum, Caribou Economic Action Forum, here for 5 years. And that, the sole purpose of that was to promote business and economic growth and to remove government barriers, in other words, to cut the red tape. And so for 5 years, we did a lot of good work, had some positive effects with doing some different things and being able to move some of the government barriers. So that was interesting. And in the interim, I did the negotiations for the Caribou Land Use Plan. I was the negotiator for the, I guess what they called the brown side at the time, but that, I think, can't remember, but I think there was 15 different groups that I represented at the table. And we're the only place in BC at that, for a number of years, that had a negotiated settlement to the War in the Woods. And we did that with the, I guess, so-called Greens. I don't like those labels because I think they're pretty unfair to both sides. Because I know some people that would call themselves environmentalists and would be quite insulted that you would think they were brown because they happen to believe in some form of industry on the land base. And I get so. I think, the labels are wrong, but that was a very interesting process because the government process under Stephen Owen failed here. It collapsed. And we some of us got together and said, look, we think a deal can be done here. And so we went to government, and government, in their wisdom, and I think it was the right move, said, let's give this a shot. And so the green side and the brown side, as they called us, we got together, and they brought in a government negotiator, but he was sort of a shuttle diplomat in the process. And we actually put together a land use plan here that, if it hadn't been for these bugs, I think would have been sustainable into the long term, and would have been great. The problem right now that I see with the bugs is that we're over-harvesting. We know we're over-harvesting. I'm not sure that's good or bad. I'm not sure that's a wrong decision, but I know what it does do is that we're going to have a fall down in forestry that nobody thought was possible, because we're going to over-harvest so much that to have timber that's usable, it's going to take a long time, because we're going to have logged way more than we should have. And that's unfortunate, because we had a land use plan here that I think could have stood the test of time. It would have provided long-term sustainability for a whole number of groups out there, right from tourism operators to, you know, the backcountry guys and the more upscale and the forestry guys. I think we could have had it all. And I think that, unfortunately, because of the bugs, we're probably, I think we've over-harvested to the point that I don't think the land use plan is, what we were trying to do is gone. I don't think it's doable. It's just gone.
Okay, and I've got one question for you that's very broad, but it's something I want to ask everybody just to see what comes up, which is, how do you feel about trees?
I think I love trees, actually. I always said to Dave needs tongue-in-cheek, actually, but I used to tell Dave that the only difference between him and I was he loved his trees vertical and I loved mine horizontal. But you know, that's kind of just a when you're working with people, you gotta poke each other now and then, and that was sort of our jousting session. But I think, from a very personal perspective, trees have been my livelihood. My father worked in the forest industry, so all my life they've been our way of earning a living. And so they're pretty near and dear to me. And I think that's why this bug thing is so devastating. Because if you've been involved and you know what's going on out in the land base, you know we're over-harvesting, we know that there's no replacement coming for those trees that we're taking now, because we're taking them too soon, and we're taking too many. You know that you're seeing the end of a way of life for a lot of people. And so that's the sad thing about it. I mean, trees are, they've been my lifeline, you know? I mean, they've clothed us, fed us, put my kids through school. And I was looking at it and I was thinking, you know, my son, he's in the forest industry. And he, you know, he's a young man with a family. And I look at it and say, well, what's he going to do? You know, what replaces that for those people? And there's tons of them out there. I mean, you look around, you look at all the people involved in the forest industry, and you say, well, what have we got to offer them once this forest industry goes down the tube? And I think it's going to go down the tube in a major way. There will always be some forestry. Eh? It won't totally disappear. But it's going to become such a skeleton of its former self that you won't recognize it.
And Dave, who's the Dave you were?
Dave Neitz. He was the negotiator for the green side when we did the land use stuff.
Okay.
Pretty good guy.
Thanks. I think we're covered here.
And he's actually involved in that bug coalition on the board. Well, that was a rambling interview.
That was wonderful. Thank you so much.
That was Wade Fisher. Coming up on future podcasts, one of the founders of Forest Ethics, Sapora Berman, and the president and CEO of the Forest Stewardship Council of Canada, Anthony Marcel. For the Tyee, I'm Mark Laren-Young.